Hello, I'm James Sandy, and this is the New Curiosities Box, a zesty slice of arts and culture from Birmingham and beyond. In this show, we take a delve into Asian blues with guitar-wielding empath and serial collaborator Aziz Ibrahim. We get serious about comedy with the comedian, compere, and leading Glee Club protagonist Andy Robinson. And we cast ourselves wider than ever before as we step to the other side of the world to talk to new music maestros, Side. If you've missed any of our shows to date or would like to find more information on some of the artists and projects that we've covered, check out our blog at www.thenewcuriositiesbox.blogspot.co.uk. We start with a man who has pushed forward through the realms of pop, indie and Asian music, using his guitar as a key to new worlds, instruments and possibilities. Charging up his energy banks prior to a performance of his recent Project 70 with Hardeep Bindal, I caught up with Aziz Ibrahim at the Mac. I'm with Aziz Ibrahim, and we're hiding back somewhere out in the back of the Mac.
Correct, in a very swanky dressing room. Dressing room number one.
Palatial is the word.
Numero uno.
Indeed. And it's great to catch up with you, because I'm really interested in Project 70 Asian Blues. Okay.
Yeah. Which is over now.
Well, tell me a little bit about that and tell me what comes next.
I'm on Project 71 Desi Guitar now.
Okay, so let's start with the idea of Asian blues. Yeah. Okay, when people think about blues, they probably think about John Lee Hooker, don't they? But there's a lot more to what you're doing.
Yeah, well, I mean, obviously, you know, my background, cultural background, that's one thing. Hmm. But say, in terms of my works, that people know is generally in the mainstream. So whether it be Stone Roses, Ian Brown, or Paul Weller, or then maybe even if you into the other forms of music that I like, because I like all manner of music, and the work I did with Asia, the prog rock group, and then with the prog rock artists like the Yellow Magic Orchestra and Japan and other groups.
You've done a lot of things. Looking you up, you've done a lot of things.
Yeah, then there's a lot of stuff that's not online because I haven't actually put a decent resume up there. There's a lot of reggae music. In the early days, working with the likes of Dennis Brown, the late Dennis Brown, and Barrington Levy, and Freddie McGregor, Errol Dunkley, and then Hot Chocolate, and even in Birmingham, you know, working with Ruby Turner as a musical director.
That's a fantastic list already, isn't it? And you've not even mentioned people like Telvin Singh.
We were friends, and he did his album OK, and I was doing my debut album, so we did an exchange, you know, me on his and his on mine. I did the same thing with Paul Weller, and played for him, and he did some playing and singing for me, which is great, without a record contract.
And you've also worked, I think, with the other half of the Smiths. And when I say the other half, I mean not the two that
are
always two in
camps.
The limelight. You know?
Well, there's two camps.
So Rourke and Joyce is who we're talking about.
Yeah, so originally when I launched my first album, Lahore to Longsight, which is the show that I'm doing with the orchestra at the moment, the Manchester Camerata Orchestra, we debuted at Home Theatre in Manchester. So that originally was with a collection of friends, but then evolved into a band with a fantastic rhythm section, you know, the Smiths rhythm section, Andy Rourke and Mike Joyce, and myself. It kind of imploded when 9/11 hit, and all contracts and deals were cancelled, and mainly because of my name and, you know, the American tours, they were definitely off.
Really?
You know, everything was cancelled. So, but right now I've launched a new band called Asmik.
Wow.
So
that's a name, isn't it?
Yeah, Aziz and Mike Asmik, as opposed to Cosmic.
I like it already. I like the thinking behind it.
So the good Irishman that Mike is. it's a working title at the moment. We've got a new band. It's not a conventional band, you know. It's probably more. It doesn't sound like the Gorillaz, but it's a concept, as opposed to a convention of here's the lead singer who takes up this space. We're actually looking at spoken word, we're looking at films, we're looking at creating, you know, visual content and themes that were even the message of, you know, what we're trying to achieve it through the music, and maybe it's film score, maybe it's soundtrack. So that's a project I'm working on with Mike Joyce.
And you mentioned from Lahore to Longsight, which is a really interesting piece, because that's about a family journey, isn't it? That's about,
yeah, so
about
basically,
you personally, but
yeah, so this Project 70 Asian Blues, coming back to that, was about exploring identity, about questioning things that I've always questioned, because I'd worked in mainstream for so long, and for some reason I never felt that there were any barriers or things probably because nobody said don't go there or don't do this, and that I ended up in situations where no Asian, no South Asian, no Muslim man would, you know, dare to tread. So ending up in Simply Red in the 80s and ending up at orgies, things like that is a bit kind of...
I was going to say that's a good place to be. But I don't know. What I was going to mean was Simply Red, yeah. Not the other part, but you know.
Yeah, well, I mean, I don't know about that because, I mean, it was great for my experience, but, I mean, he's a guy who asked me, do I like curries? And, you know, I had to check my name. Do I like... My name's Aziz Ibrahim. My family are from India originally, and then
And then the
Pakistan.
Manchester connection, I guess, as well.
Yeah, but it's just a strange question to ask a Pakistani, do you like curry? Yeah. But, so the identity for me, I thought, well, I wrote the album, or that title track, Lahore to Longsight, based upon the stories that my dad used to tell me when he was in the Indian Army and travelling around the countryside on trains. And I used to have great dreams on as a kid, and my dad sat on the roof and watching, you know, farmers work in the fields and travelling the Indian country. And I wrote a piece of music for it, Lahore to Longsight, which is about travel, but also about leaving. Because I always thought we were from Lahore and then Lahore to Longsight, Manchester. So the journey was that. But as I explored further as I grew up and realised that partition separated India into those three factions, that actually my heritage is Indian, as much as it's Pakistani and British and Mancunian.
There's something really interesting in the title and some of the things that you explore, I think, is that essentially, I guess, it's about distance. And, you know, if you Google mapped that, for example, that's a long way, isn't it? But actually, I think some of the point you're trying to make is it's not that far. It's not that distant. It is. No. You know, it's kind of
the universal glue is music within this story, and for everything that I do, and also the language through which I'm trying to communicate. But Project 70 Asian Blues was that venture into, okay, how you know, how many times can I throw a TV out of a hotel room window? You know, it's time to learn new skills, you know, new skills.
Roger Waters has been doing that for about 50 years, I think.
Exactly. Yeah. It's been done before by people far better looking, far more wealthy. But for me, I just wanted to learn a new skill set. So I started to accumulate new partners and friends, New Art Exchange in Nottingham. I thought it was a fantastic South Asian organisation that could mentor me through the process. While I explored, I applied to the Arts Council for my grant, my first G4A, to look at partition, identity, and create music, and also look at digital, shall we say, within, whether it's in marketing, production, music, anything. You know, digital is a broad area I want to explore, and in the guitar field, because it's so kind of dominated by that conventionality, so I wanted to take it further and see where digital would go, using iPads and mainly things that maybe they're not affordable, but an iPad's more affordable than an Apple laptop, you know. That's $2,500 right there, you know. And they're getting better and better, and apps are fun, and music was always fun, you know. I never used to do it there wasn't any money. It's doing it for music, you know, enjoying it. So the iPads brought the fun factor back. Well, not that it'd gone, but I just thought now's the time to make
just
a lateral move.
Reinvigorate it a bit.
Yeah, to reinvigorate. Yeah. And explore the things that I've always thought. So Asian blues was one of these principles. I thought that there's a blues story for South Asians and also for Southeast Asians and Africa and so forth. But so I called it the Asian blues because there's a story there of four centuries of colonial rule. There's a story there of how we're treated and why we've almost assumed an identity and a role that in actual fact was brought about through census in India and map makers. And I look at that as the root of the problems we have today. So I'm trying to also look at myself and see, how do I identify myself? Is it me that's at fault? Am I capable of reverse engineering this kind of wearing this on my sleeve? And I, because in actual fact my relationship is closer with people who enjoy the music and arts and sports and recreational things that I love than it ever will be with somebody of the same color or religion or so forth. That's my bond, that's a common bond. Din din tak tita din din ak din 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 tak tita din din ak din 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 tak tita din din ak din
Yeah. You know, there's a lot, I think, now. There's a lot of potential that's readily available. In terms of technology, it's very easy to pick up an iPad.
Yeah, I mean, technology is one thing, but the art forms, I mean, on Project 70 Asian Blues, that's where I met Hardeep Pandel, who's performing tonight. He's an artist, but he's getting up. He's going to do some spoken word, rap. But I composed with my colleagues in Manchester, my team, Mixrupt, and we composed a grime tune for it. So I've started working with contemporary genres as opposed to sticking with a convention of, you know, guitars, bass, drums. I like urban music because I grew up with it. You know, I come from a council estate in Manchester, alongside M13, and that mentality, even though the age changes and I get greyer and older, but the mentality doesn't change. I've still got that hardcore street mentality. So music that relates to the streets, I still relate to that. And I'm not trying to kind of dress things up almost like mutton dressed as lamb, but I would rather experiment with genres like grime, niche, hip-hop or whatever related, just because I want to also encourage other young kids to look at the arts as a possible place to turn and the venues. I mean, my new project, Project 71, Desi Guitar, I almost want to work reclaim cultural spaces like museums, libraries, art centres as performance spaces. And also, I'm interested in the South Asian instruments. So I want to see more of that musical content within spaces like museums. I mean, you walk in a museum, I mean, they've got some great stuff, but they rarely ever have a music content. And I think, what a thing to ignore when the general population and younger generation that music is key, you know.
Yeah, it's very silent and dusty and kind of inaspic, isn't it, I guess.
Yeah, so it needs changing, and there is a move, like, you know, the council, especially the one in Manchester, that move's being made. Manchester Museum have already started building a South Asian wing. But again, I ask the question, where's the music part of that? Where's the... I mean, you might have some paintings with some royal courts with somebody playing classical music. But I want to kind of reintroduce those South Asian instruments into and mix them into creations that of, like, you know, working with contemporary genre, using my iPad and almost emulating these instruments through the guitar. That's where this Desi guitar, Desi being your own, culturally your style.
So let's touch on that then, Project 71, as a kind of a successor project, if you like. You kind of, you touched on some of the things I think that are different about that, but are there things you've learned through Project 70 that you think, well, I wouldn't do that again, or, you know, yes, we need to do more of that?
No, I think Project 70 was a good R&D stage. You know, I needed to know more about my heritage. I needed to do a lot of reading. And I began with certain books. And then I got into poetry and started reading Warisha and Bulesha, which I never really knew, and everybody else did. And I started looking at dance forms, and I was working with Anu from Austin, Texas. Because I've been working for Austin, Texas City Hall on a delegation to Pakistan. Loads of fingers in different parts.
Yeah.
I know it sounds a bit, but I explained the song I wanted to write, which was about partition, and I wanted to express the tragedy in an art form where there were no words, and I thought dance was the best way to do that. And I told her the story, and she, over a phone call, sent me a video she created, dancing basically, to that tragedy of the movement where, you know, at least 1.5 million people died in that. So. On that particular border, not just Bangladesh. My first project was also about addressing the fact that people don't recognise that Bangladesh and Pakistan were both part of India, and also that Bangladesh is the only country in the world to have independence twice. So, I started speaking to young kids, and I was realising that they weren't even aware that they were, their heritage was Indian. So that was one thing, to kind of the basics of Pakistan, India, or Bangladesh, or, you know, East Pakistan at the time, it was all India. So basic things like this in education, I wanted to start showing that in through digital formats of maps coming together and showing the country, you know, merging together, or just composing music through the anthems. The anthems was another theme I was working on, because the anthems are almost, they're militarized, aren't they? So I researched into the composers, and one of the pieces I'm playing tonight is based on the composer for the Indian and Bengali national anthem.
Just to finish, I wanted to ask you, you're a kind of, I guess you're a guitarist by trade, aren't you? But we've talked about a lot of different things that you've done.
Guitar is, it's by trade, but
I guess because that's what it says on your passport, as your profession or something like that.
Well, it says on my social media, you know, a guitarist first and foremost, singer, songwriter, producer, but I'd give it all up to be in the NBA, because basketball is actually my first love. The guitar is actually my controller. It's my digital controller, in a sense, that even now I'm working with the iPad and I'm working with apps, mainly because, you know, they're free or they're cheap to buy. What I do know is my way around the guitar. So the guitar is my interface to most things in life, whether it's socializing or whether it's just generally collaborating or composing new music through, you know, like I said, contemporary genres or relating to people. Yeah, it is. But I see it more as like an interface, as opposed to this is my instrument.
Well, Aziz, it's been great to catch up with you, and it's been great to have a conversation, and I'm really looking forward to the show.
Nice to have some intelligent questions for a change.
Thanks for your time. Cheers. Thanks.
No worries.
You can find more about Aziz and his amazing career and music at www.aziz.co.uk. This is the New Curiosities Box, and I'm James Sandy. Now the dazzling lights of the cruel stage call as we consider comedy, audiences, and that definite need for some jokes. As I talk to regular compere of the Thursday night comedy carousel and seasoned comedian Andy Robinson, we started with birds.
Right, so I'm here, hiding out in earshot of the ducks and the pigeons in the Mac.
That's right.
So if you hear some wildlife, it's not Andy Robinson. It's the kind of fauna around Cannon Hill Park, let's call it that. But Andy, it was great to catch up because I'm really intrigued by Comedy Carousel, which is something that fairly regularly happens, I think, at the Glee Club.
It happens,
somewhere,
James.
In the Arcadian. Is that where it
happens?
It
happens right in the Arcadian in Birmingham City Centre at the Glee Club. And it's not only sometimes, it happens every Thursday.
Every Thursday.
It's a show we do pretty much every Thursday, yeah.
So that must be quite demanding, is it?
Yeah, it is quite demanding. It keeps you on your toes, certainly.
So it's quite, I guess in some ways it's a traditional showcase of stand-up, is it?
What we have on this particular show, James, I'm doing my selling now, we have comedians, established what they might call circuit acts, doing sets. We sometimes have like shorter sets from up-and-coming comedians. And then myself and my colleague, Adam Jeremko, we kind of host the evening. Well, I host it and Adam helps me out great with a lot of stuff of looking around the internet, looking at news. We do a sort of fake Twitter account called Oinka on the thing, and also there's a lot of spontaneity. It's like a pretty much straight stand-up traditional show, but there's like a little twist, if you like, which myself and Adam like to exploit.
So Adam was going to be with us, but unfortunately he's poorly. So I have to wish him, if he's listening to this, he's tucked up in bed.
Oh, miss you, Adam.
With a Lemsip or something, I imagine. Nothing harder than that. We'll send him our best wishes.
Yeah, and he does a lot of work on the show as well, so it's a shame that he's not here in a way, but, you know, as an egotist and the person who's at the front, I'm delighted.
You know, I think it's commitment. I think that's the key word, isn't it?
We'll leave
that there. So you mentioned the internet, and obviously the internet is virtually ubiquitous, isn't it? You know, it's kind of everywhere and anywhere.
It's part of our lives, James. In the last, I'd say 10-15 years, I was watching a thing the other day when the floods were on, Beast from the East, and they were going around the people's houses, and one bloke, I thought this was quite good, they were saying, how are you coping with this weather? And this bloke on this news item, he says, it's all right, we've got the internet. And I thought, well, this...
That's all you need, isn't
well,
it?
Well, I thought it was very telling for 2018, you know, that the...
It's probably keeping warm around his broadband router.
Possibly, yeah, maybe he's getting all his food delivered, or maybe he was just watching funny videos of cats, whatever it was. He did not need the outside world, and I thought this was emblematic of maybe all of our takes on the internet.
They do say it's the new teletext, don't they? That's what they say about it. I think that's the way to look at it.
Yeah.
So is it mainly... So when you're looking at the internet and you're trying to trawling the internet for material, is it stuff that is funny, that is perhaps kind of, you know, begging to be referenced? Or is it stuff that you sort of stumble upon and think, that's a bit awkward, that's a bit odd?
I don't know, really. I mean, it's a thing. There's definitely a little touch of look at this, look at that, you know, especially stuff that might be in the consciousness of that week. But then also, you know, we find odd things, or I find odd things on the internet and turn them into comedy. And like I say, throughout the evening, there's also a spontaneous... This is only part of the show. It's by no means the whole carousel. But sometimes we spontaneously find things to use during the show as well, which is a kind of alchemy of some sort, maybe, without being too pretentious, which I've just been. So that's part of the show. But, you know, it's a lot of stand-up, a lot of comedians. And because it's a Thursday, and maybe comedy night's usually on a Friday and Saturday by and large. So
it's a kind of warm-up of a warm-up, is that it?
I'm going to say, James, it's a thing in itself. It's a Thursday night show, so we get different... groups of people, different types of people, people who aren't necessarily up for the more, let's call it, visceral thrill of a Saturday night. I mean, it's been going for three and a half, four years, something like that, and to have a weekly show on every Thursday with a audience is a real treat, you know.
So how did you come to that? So, you know, I imagine that you were walking down the street one day and someone said, there he is, there's Andy Robinson, star.
Give us our money back.
Star of the... Give us a refund. So how did you come to it? Was comedy something you explored? Was it sort of accidental? How did it happen?
How did I become a comedian?
Yeah.
I suppose, I mean, I always think this about comedians a little bit, it's a relatively common question of why did you become a comedian? How did you become a comedian? That's no offence to your question.
No.
But I suspect it's probably because we didn't get hugged enough as a child.
Is that what it was? You maybe. Were taking fishing or something?
Well, when I look at other comedians and I hear about their past and their emotional state, I think, well, there absolutely might be something to this. But I don't know. I suppose it was a need to show off, James. It was a bit of a need for attention. It was, you know, being from Birmingham, growing up, I remember this vividly. Jasper Carrot in the late 70s. I thought, he's good. Lenny Henry in the 80s. I thought, he's good. Frank Skinner in the 90s, I thought, he's good. And I think for me, it was a touch of those three men in particular, the notion that maybe you could be from this city and do that for a job, as opposed to, let's call it, the Oxbridge.
It's the Footlights Clan. Those kind of people. Yeah.
So I thought it was quite... I think seeing those three in particular made me... You know, they often mention barbers in Smethwick or the market in Dudley or Jasper Carrot, especially Haycock Green. Just, I think even as a child, made me think... I think it planted a little seed in me, certainly, you know. The bigger question of why did I choose to do it might be something to do with attention.
There is there is a fabric, which I'm going to use that word, but there is a fabric of...
It's a good word.
You said pretentious earlier on about alchemy, so I thought I'd use... So there is a fabric
of attention,
James. Yeah, get it in there. There's a fabric of comedy, I think, about Birmingham. And I wonder if Brummies are naturally funny people, in the sense... And what I don't mean by that is... That accent kind of lends itself to being lampooned, and the accent is very different.
Which it does
places.
A little bit.
It does a little bit. Yeah. I think there's a very warm, generous kind of streak in Birmingham folk that perhaps that lends itself to that.
I think so. I think comedians who come up to the city, I mean, it's difficult for me because I live here and I am one, but other comedians often talk about this city and the audiences more specifically, I suppose, and think there is a... there's definitely a touch of self-deprecation and they don't take themselves or the city or their, I guess, just their way of life as seriously as other cities, that's for certain. I think there's a sense of fun about it. You know, there's a few jokes that you can do, usually.
You do need those, I guess.
They're really handy now and again, despite my best efforts. But, you know, there's a few jokes you can do in a lot of other places, but I suppose cities that have a bit more of an... inherent pride about who they are, where they're from. I think Birmingham's pretty good for that. If you're going to go down that route, which of course would only be a part of any comedian set, it wouldn't be the defining thing. But I think there is a little sense in Birmingham audiences that just a little bit of joy, I suppose, and a lack of taking anything too seriously, which is very handy for comedy.
I think some of those names that you've mentioned, my view on it is really that what's great about those kind of people is that they've avoided a key thing, and that key thing is just having Birmingham as their only reference.
Yeah.
You know, we went in the 90s, we went through a spate of Irish comedians, Geordie comedians, okay, of which there are some very good Irish and Geordie comedians.
Of course.
But for some of those comedians, that slightly twangy accent, again, you know, I'm in dangerous ground, but, you know, that was perhaps the thing that they played on most, you know, and there are perhaps people now who use that as the badge before...
the accent, you mean?
Yeah.
Yeah, I suppose.
And I think some of those folks you mentioned have avoided all of that, you know, got a very sort of a more global view of things, I guess.
Yeah, and I suppose it was about the 70s, 80s and 90s, and then... In the noughties, you've kind of got Joe Lycett, who's doing great things at the moment, being from Birmingham, and he hasn't got the slightest twang of an accent at all, but he still references this city and the psychology and what goes on there. So, you know, I think it's true that maybe the accent isn't such a...
He does use, I think, famously use what I would call the ghost of Larry Grayson. something wonderful about how he kind of channels that.
Yeah, I mean, he's got the magic, that boy.
He's
anyway,
bit,
I'm not here
he's
to
got
talk.
A bit of magic.
No, he really has. He's great. He's a great act. He's done Carousel.
So let's come back to Carousel, because he's a good example, because he's someone that has come through and been on that platform. So tell us a bit about some of the other acts or some of the other names that have kind of passed through. So we've got, you know, we do have, as you mentioned, up and coming people, which is great. You know, it's a kind of it's a training.
That's only a part of that show. I mean, I'm very keen, although we do have new and up and coming acts, who all, you know, not all of them actually, but a lot of them are really good, but they're sort of new. But in the past, we've had, well, like Joe's done it, and Kevin Bridges has popped in a couple of times to do our show. Josh Widdicombe, I think, did it a while ago. Ramesh Ranganathan, so we've had names, but also we have quite a lot of, you know, just great, great circuit acts and on the comedy circuit at the moment, well, always actually, there are some hilarious people who I'm going to say that people who are not necessarily staying watching television or not up to date with comedy, we have really great, great circuit acts who may or may not become the next big thing. Who's to say?
So we talk mainly about, I guess, what I would say is 20% of the show, which is the comedian. The 80%, you see what I'm doing there? See, maths is very straightforward. The 80%, I guess, is the audience. You know, how you know, the audience are key, aren't they? If you can't get the reaction or you can't get that connection with the audience, you are sunk, can't you?
Absolutely. You're only as good as your audience. And in this show, it's not a show where we drag people up or make anyone do anything they don't want to do or, you know, pick on people. But absolutely, the audience is a part of this show. And I think this is maybe part of its, why it's been relatively long running for the last few years and hopefully the next few as well, because it's a spontaneous. A lot of aspects of the night cannot be repeated.
Are they a regular crowd? Have you got kind of regulars that come
in? We have people coming back, absolutely, yeah. And new people and recommendations. And obviously, there's a real inherent thing sometimes where you think, oh, you've heard about this from other people as well, you know. So, yeah. I mean, we're doing pretty good for that, I think, relatively, again, for a Thursday. And for a show that's every week, we do get quite a lot of repeat, I'm going to say custom, but a lot of repeat audiences, you know.
Now, let me ask you about another important thing, which I think is a bit like a kind of PPI call for a comedian, which is the heckle. You know, that uncomfortable, oh, I'm not sure how to respond to this. Do you get people shouting? You know, the worst, I guess, is do some jokes. You know, I've heard that a number of times. Not from personally being on the stage, no. I should add.
It's a great heckle, though, because I think if someone is being asked to do some jokes, it means they're not doing enough jokes. They might be talking about their life a bit more or expressing a personal point of view, but jokes are really, really handy for comedy, so that is a good heckle. But yeah, get it sometimes, a bit of heckling, you know. To be honest, especially on this show on a Thursday, it's more joining in than heckling and that. And, you know, I've been doing this job a ridiculously long time. The number of good heckles I've had, I think I can count on one hand, you know. It's usually people trying to join in, which is great, or people being drunk, which is not so great, but that can be funny as well. And it's a great thing for a comedian, you know, stops it being a monologue. You don't want it too much, you don't want it to get out of control and people feeling they say a thing, but, you know, I'm more for a little bit of what I like to call gritting the oyster, because it stops it turning into just a recital, you know. Go to see a theatre if you want to see a recital, can't you?
Indeed you can. Yeah. There's plenty of those as well, I guess, in Birmingham. Yeah. Now, one of the things I noticed that the Glee Club did recently, I think it was on the 1st of April, what a great day to choose, was it was a family kind of show, this kind of things for kids and the sort of focused shows for younger folks. I reckon that's an even more difficult thing, isn't it? In terms of, you know, stuff that adults and children find funnier, kind of, you know.
Yeah, well,
I
suppose.
The main point is difficult to find.
I mean, me personally, I've done maybe 3 or 4 what they call kids shows, child shows, younger audience shows in my life. And talk about heckles, children's heckles are maybe the most brutal and honest and direct ones you get, you know. That sort of, this isn't funny, and what are you doing? And
there's an honesty, isn't
yeah,
there?
Yeah, they're brilliant kids for that. Like, so I'm not necessarily one of those acts. I've done 3 or 4. Again, I think that there is a similarity, really. I mean, I think with stand-up, it's remarkably close to, I'm going to call it being a supply teacher sometimes, where you're going into alien rooms, you're having to control a room and impress them, impart some information, keep it under control, you'll probably never see them again. And I suppose a kid's gig is a little bit like that. You know, I suppose it's just making an impact on a group of people, whether they are 4 or 44. I don't know. Yeah. But the Glee Club are doing that, absolutely, as a few clubs are. Live entertainment is important. Well, no, it is important. And however you want to partake in it is up to you, of course. But you can't beat the live experience, I think.
It's seeing it in the flesh, isn't it? Seeing it, you know, like theatre and music, it's actually hearing it and seeing it perform that makes a real difference. You know, you get a lot of live shows on television, live comedy shows, you know, Night of the Apollo and all that kind of stuff, until you've actually seen it in the flesh. It's a different
well, it's such a communal experience, isn't it? Not only with the performer to the audience, but you're also around other members of the audience. You know, given the choice, go and see something live, I always say, you know, although you can stay in and order a takeaway and all that, but, you know, life's too short, I think.
Indeed. I'm with you on that one. Okay. Just to finish up, let's just remind folks of where they can see you impart your gift to an audience. So it's every Thursday night.
Every Thursday at the Glee Club, doing this show Comedy Carousel. If you've been unimpressed with this interview, do not worry, because we have loads of other people on the night as well. And in the truest showbiz tradition, there should be something for everyone in that show, especially on the Thursday Comedy Carousel at the Glee Club.
So if folks want tickets and information, they can go online, look at the website.
Absolutely, go on the Glee Club website. Often, I believe, you can maybe even purchase on the night, although the show starts at 8, so I certainly suggest getting there by 7:30 to make sure you can get in, get a seat, and all that stuff. But yeah, I mean, it's a weekly show, so knock yourself out, really, online or on the hoof.
Excellent. And like radio interviews, when you get to the end, there is no refund.
No.
Andy, thanks very much for your
thank
time.
You, James. Thank you very much for having me. I appreciate it.
Thank you. Thanks.
And now we set the controls for the other side of the globe as I speak to the Melbourne duo Side about the wonders of their lo-fi sound, working through the stages of music production, and their plans for world domination. Satellites to the ready.
So, by the wonders of modern technology, half a world away, joining me on the line now are Will and Mitch from Side. Let's start off with that name, because it's a really interesting name, and folks that will spell it correctly will have to put, I think it's called an umlaut over the Y. Help us explore that name. Where does that come from?
Yeah, so you pronounce it Side, and so basically the name is a combination of our last names, Stevens, Hyde, Side. And so we went to school together and we needed a name. We were starting off super young, and then Side sort of is something that was interesting. And yeah, I mean, it sort of stuck like it.
Yeah, we definitely had a long process of choosing a name that was kind of, it sounded nice and also fitting to our style of music. And
yeah,
so after a lot of thought and discussion, kind of stuck with that.
The umlaut is actually like two people. Well, we thought,
European
style, the way we write is quite sort of European influence, so it sort of goes hand in hand as well.
So let's talk a little bit about how you guys started and sort of obviously, you know, you've explained quite well how you came up with your name, but how did you sort of get into music and particularly your style of music?
Well, starting like end of year 7 or during year 8, so what, we were like 13, super young. Will and I met in high school. Hadn't known each other for too long.
I actually didn't like Mitch that much at the start, but
yeah, I think you found me a bit annoying. I only just found out.
I think, don't you?
Yeah.
Every now and
then. And then music brought us together. So
yeah, I think he knew I had a bit of an interest in it. I tried DJing with a friend, and then Will had me over and we started pumping out some tunes.
Yeah, I think that was when we started, like, not consciously, but I think definitely we got a feel for, you know, song structure and everything. I don't want to dig too deep into it, but we definitely started to get a bit musical around that period. Yeah, and sense of rhythm and everything helped from DJing young.
So when you're writing and producing music, DJing's something that, a bit of an unknown really to people. People think it's just, you know, pressing play. There's a lot more to it than that. So what did you start building around? Did you have ideas for tunes or for songs, or did you have music perhaps that you've both been listening to?
Well, it was actually quite a contrast between the DJ stuff at the start, where we're just doing house parties with friends. And then we kind of realized that that's not really the music we're passionate about, like we actually enjoy that much. We definitely found that when we started making our own tunes, you know, downloads and like music production software on our computers, and started playing around. And I dabbled with guitar in primary school, Will the same with piano, kind of came up with this style that, you know, hear in our tunes.
Yeah.
So it's actually quite different from the DM we did at the start, that's for sure.
Yeah, I think that we, you know, so we took some like lessons here and there, but there wasn't really too much that we like, that we've learnt the most just from ourselves, just writing a bunch of music and starting so young. We've definitely developed methods and like ways that we work and figured out how to write quicker, which has just come over time. And yeah, now we're writing how we write today, and it's, we've got our own unique things that we're doing that I think, you know, separates us a bit.
And I guess that that's changed as you've sort of, you know, sort of developed, I guess, as a group, as a duet, as it were. And but also, I guess technology's helped sort of develop your sound, has it?
Yeah, I mean, without the internet and, you know, without, you know, being able to search the web for samples and, you know, cool sound design banks that we can toy with, you know, that it wouldn't be possible. And I think, you know, I mean, the way we actually source our singers, and if we're ever looking, you know, yeah, to get a vocalist in, we'll use the internet like constantly. So it's a big part of what we do to try and find new talent to put on tracks.
Now, there's something you mentioned which I really like in music, which is something I would call kind of lo-fi, okay? If folks listening know what that means, that's a kind of, you know, have a go and break it technique, isn't it? You know, you kind of plug lots of things into a laptop, see what it sounds like. Would you say that's a fair description of, you know, that kind of lo-fi sort of almost, I suppose, ambient is another term people use, but ambient's a bit more developed and a bit more technical sometimes, I think.
Yeah, I think the kind of carefree way we go about our music production is definitely influenced in our tracks, and how it just starts with a basic idea from either guitar or a little beat that one of us makes kind of gives that sound, as you said, lo-fi.
Yeah, definitely. I think that's like the perfect way to sum it up. And like also going on from that, organic as well is probably like a word that we'd use to describe our music. Just like we're not producers who are trying to go for like the most polished sound. You know, we want our track to have some organic.
Yeah, bedroom aspect kind of to it.
We don't mind if it sounds a bit like it's made in a bedroom, because we think it's still vibey, then we think other people will like it too, you know.
So let's talk about a couple of those tracks, all of the things that you've done to date that folks can listen to, and in fact we'll play bits of that in the show. Let's talk about Orbit first. Kind of breakthrough track for you, I guess. That's the kind of thing that sort of put you on the map.
Yeah, exactly. That's pretty much what made us take music seriously, really. Like, we were writing before that, but we had no validation to know what we were doing was great and or like good at all.
We're definitely toying with different genres at that point, and we weren't really sure in our direction. But once we saw that kind of take off a little bit on the platform of Spotify, as Will said, validation it gave us for future projects.
Yeah.
As you can kind of hear with Above the Cloud, similar style.
Yeah. And because we're producers, you know, we can easily write other genres, and we'll write in dancier stuff, but this, you know, we like the chiller indie acoustic vibe that Orbit has, and you know, we like the way that it makes you feel, I think, listening to it, as cheesy as that sort of is. But yeah, definitely that made us pursue that type of sound, because we were already vibing with it.
Thank you.
So when you're working with vocalists and when you're working around lyrics, in particular, I'm interested in, how does that work? So you know, you'd have an idea for a song or, you know, kind of words kind of put together. So when you work with, it's not really a third party, but when you invite a vocalist to sort of support your music, how does that work? Does the voice shape that song, or does the song naturally lead to a particular person that you kind of can think of?
Well, we've kind of learned that track to track changes, but most of the time, the song that we make, the instrumental, would lead to a type of vocalist, and we can kind of, Will and I, when we're on the same page, kind of envision a type of voice on a track.
Yeah.
So then we'll look online, and Will does heaps of this work, just searching endlessly for the right voice for it, and then we'll just, I guess, get heaps of demos from various vocalists that fit that group, that fit that style.
I think it's sort of, for us, like, that's a super important part as well. And, like, we want to try and build that into our, you know, A&R in vocalists. So for us, we're picky in that we want, you know, a vocalist who vibes with direction and where we want to go, and also is passionate about the project and will support it. So, yeah, we always pretty much know once we've written the beat who exactly to go for. Like, it could be, we've always got, like, vocalists on our radar, but yeah, pretty much just hit up 10 vocalists or so and get demos and then tweak lyrically from there.
So your latest single is Above the Clouds, and that's a really interesting track. And I noticed a video, I think for that recently. People are having fun, which I'm not sure is allowed anymore, is it?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, we sort of played around with that video a bit because we went with that, you know, having fun, being able to do whatever you want to do, which is the core to the track's message, as well as having that little twist at the end, which I'm sure you saw. And yeah, so we just played around with a sort of sinister end, which sort of we think gave a unique
twist on the interpretation, I guess. That, you know, some people's view of having fun is wrongdoing, and others is lighthearted fun with mates, I guess. So you got both of those like kind of ideas.
So you mentioned earlier on things like Spotify and SoundCloud and those kind of platforms that I think people, you know, they're kind of ubiquitous now. People use them for pretty much daily, don't they, to kind of find new things. And you also alluded to the fact that you kind of got a DJing past, or you kind of you've earned your spurs, as it were, as you know, DJ. I was just interested in in the UK, vinyl. There's a huge vinyl explosion. There's a reawakening in terms of, you know, people buying 12 inches and 7 inches, those kind of things. Is that something in Australia that's similar? Is that something you're tapping into, or is it mainly online?
Yeah, there'll always be trends in with everything in life, I guess. I've definitely seen that over here. People have found that if you can kind of touch the music, then you know some people value that higher. But the online platforms are always going to dominate, I think, in this world.
Yeah,
where it's so easy to listen to a song on Spotify. But yeah, you're right in that. There's definitely been an increase in
vinyl sales.
Yeah, in vinyl sales, in Australia as well.
Just to finish, I just wanted to, there's a couple of last questions. One was, for folks listening, I just wanted to really make sure that they could find where you are online and check out your web-based stuff. So there's a website, sidesound.com. Is that the best place for folks to go?
Yeah, like that's a good starting point. Or if you just want to jump straight to music and look at our story later, then Spotify. You can type in side, and there's an umlaut on the Y, but either way you'll find it.
Yeah.
Or on SoundCloud, being Spotify is the easiest way. Apple, Pandora.
And what about your plans for world domination? So obviously you're setting Australia on fire, as it were. But have you got plans to sort of do tours or sort of gigging in particular parts of the world? Or
yeah, that's the so at the moment we're just actually putting our live show together, and that's definitely a new stage, new chapter for us.
Yeah.
Quite interesting, because a lot of bands start out the opposite way. They'll perform in pubs or whatever you like at the start, whereas we've kind of gone online first and tried to gain some traction there, so that the fans and I guess the people who want to hear our music are already there. And then when we go live, you have people who already love your music and want to share it with you.
We've done, like, I think, the tough road first and, like, mastering the production. Even though we're not masters and we probably never will be, like, we think we're at a good stage right now of our production. And then going on to just play those, we're looking forward to doing that. Mitch will be on guitar, I'll be on keys and drumming, so it should be interesting.
It's very exciting. I think the journey itself is the exciting bit, isn't it, in all of that. So I wish you all the best of luck. I mean, I'm really excited about the music. But for now, Will and Mitch of Side in sunny Australia. I hope it's sunny there. Thanks so much.
Yes, still just is.
Thanks for having us.
Thanks for us.
Thank you so much.
Appreciate it.
You can find out even more about Side and their sound by checking them out on Spotify, SoundCloud and Facebook. Their new single, Above the Clouds, featuring Olivia Reid, is out now. And now it's time to close the box. Check out our show archive at www.kingofthebuttons.co.uk. My thanks to Aziz Ibrahim, Mac Birmingham, Andy Robinson, Side, 448 Creative, Infectious PR, and Lucky Ent. The New Curiosities Box is written and presented by me, James Sandy, and is a King of the Buttons production for 107.5 Switch Radio.